This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health science and innovation. I'm Todd Bookman, filling in for Mike and Scott. In the world of physicians, there are dozens and dozens of specialties and subspecialties. Oncology, orthopedic surgery, neurology, anesthesiology. The ologies seem to go on and on and on. But if pressed, you could easily divide doctors into two camps, specialists and generalists. And in recent years, those generalists, think your family physician, their numbers have been declining at an alarming rate. It's a problem the medical establishment is struggling with. But to solve it, you need to first understand what's going through the head of a recent med school graduate. We asked first-year resident and occasional Pulse contributor Avir Mitra to look into why so many new doctors are choosing specialties.
Yo, what's up, man? How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Oh my God, tired.
Okay, I was recently on the phone with my friend and I had an odd request for him. Like me, he graduated from medical school a year ago and is doing his residency. So now, a year out, I wanted him to read me his application essay for med school.
All right, man. It's okay. I'm here. I trust you. I mean, this is like the most cheesiest that I've read in my life. Like, this is the that I write.
Okay, so obviously nobody likes to read their personal statements to their friends, let alone on the radio. But he said he would if we didn't use his name.
Over time, I realized my fulfillment will be brought upon by a career path that measured success, not by dollars, but rather by service.
That's awesome. I mean, that's all great stuff.
I mean, I'm like going full ham right now, so, you know.
Here's the thing, though. If you knew him, you'd see that he's actually pretty sincere about these type of statements. He's a great doctor, the type we need more of. You know, really smart, but also down to chit-chat with you and get to know you. Anyway, it was his closing line that struck me.
In difficult times, I will measure success not by monetary standards, but by the strength of the relationships that I build with my patients and their families over their entire lives.
Their entire lives. That's the phrase that got me thinking. When we apply to med school, I think a lot of us imagine having lifelong relationships with patients. But actually, that's more or less exclusive to the primary care specialties. You know, like your family doctor.
Like, you create great relationships with people. When you meet a patient, like, that patient ends up loving you. So, I don't know, that line is certainly cheesy, but it's really awesome, and I feel like you would make for an amazing primary care doctor.
I appreciate you saying that. Thanks, man. I think, you know, the same for you. I think, you know, you're a great guy, but we both ended up in specialties that are not primary care.
Yeah.
It's true. I decided to specialize in emergency medicine, so I usually see patients once and never again. And my friend went into radiology, so he pretty much doesn't see patients at all. And obviously both of those fields are crucial, but I guess that general practitioners are the ones most of us think of when we picture doctors. I mean, it's certainly the image we had in mind when we applied to medical school. So my question is, why didn't we go with the obvious choice? Why didn't we choose primary care?
There's data to suggest that in the mid to late 1990s, about 50% of all U.S. medical school graduates were choosing primary care careers. And current estimates are that that's below 20%.
That's Colin West, a primary doctor and professor of medicine at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. He's a prominent researcher on the economics of primary care.
Really, what's happened over the last couple of decades is that the pipeline of future primary care physicians has really slowed down.
As a result, today roughly 30% of physicians practice primary care. That's compared to 70% 50 years ago. And although it's hard to say for sure, most researchers believe that with our expanding and aging population, we're going to have a shortage of primary doctors on the order of 52,000 within 10 years. Now, if you consider that an average primary doctor cares for about 2,000 patients, that adds up to a lot of people who can't get an appointment. So you'd think desperate pre-meds and med students would be lining up to fill the demand, right? Nope.
A few years ago, only about 6% of graduating medical students planned a career in family medicine, and only 2% planned a career in general or primary care internal medicine.
Did you hear that? 2%. And every year, primary care residency slots go unfilled. But I don't know, maybe we don't need generalists. Maybe that's a thing of the past. I mean, why not just visit specialists as needed?
Primary care is really the front line of medicine. It's really taking care of the entire patient.
And that's important, because without primary care,
there's no one really tying it all together.
It's like a great team with no quarterback. Without a primary provider, no one is coordinating. No one is seeing the whole picture. According to Dr. West, primary care requires a holistic understanding of the patient. It sees a problem in the context of the patient's other problems, their personality, their family, their environment. It requires a skill set way beyond textbook medicine.
We also know that subspecialty-driven care without primary care coordination is more expensive.
That financial perspective is echoed by Dr. G. Richard Olds, the founding dean of the University of California Riverside Medical School and the current president at St. George's University Medical School. Here he is.
Yeah, I think people intrinsically understand they don't have enough primary care doctors because they're having trouble finding one. But as a health system, we fail to realize that we're paying a huge financial price for not having enough primary care doctors.
Most healthcare researchers agree that good primary care is the bedrock of a healthy society. Countries that value primary care spend less money and have better health outcomes. It's important work, and it sounds like a great setup for a career, right? So how come most of my friends aren't choosing it?
Well, you know, for me, it started with my dad, who was a classic primary care physician, came from India, did primary care.
This is Zubin Damania, a general internal medicine doctor who trained at Stanford 15 years ago.
And from his mouth to my ear, as I was entering medical school, he said, do not do primary care. Whatever you do, go do dermatology, go do cardiology, be a radiologist, do something where you have a good lifestyle, make money, and you're paid to work with your hands, because that's how our system pays us. It pays you to do things to people, not to do things for people. And primary care is doing things for people.
Well, Dr. Damania went into general practice anyway, but it turns out there are huge forces at work pushing impressionable medical students away from primary care. Here's a big one, and it's something every medical student has heard. It has to do with the lack of respect.
Oh, well, why would you do that? You're too smart for that.
She was told by faculty that they're, quote, too smart to go into family medicine.
You should specialize. The smart people specialize. People who can't specialize go into primary care because they can't do anything else.
Everyone I interviewed for this story independently said the exact same thing. In a system which values technical knowledge over relationships, the doctor who's an authority on a given body part often feels superior to the doctor who's an authority on the patient as a whole.
I think that goes back to a sort of societal direction. We've drifted off track. We don't prioritize population health, public health, and the things that primary care infrastructure is so important for. We're really enamored of the latest, greatest technology, the fanciest interventions, the miracle cures. That's the subspecialty domain.
And so primary care, at least within our medical culture, is seen as the domain for underachievers. It even feels like that bias is inherent in the terminology. I mean, of all the words we could use, we call specialists specialists. Who doesn't want to be special? Who wants to go up to their mom and be like, I've decided my passion, it's being general? We could, of course, call specialists specifists. After all, that would be more accurate. Or we could call the generalists globalists, but the names have stuck. Another huge problem is the insane amount of paperwork that primary doctors have to do.
The bureaucratic aspects of medicine have really rolled downhill onto the primary care areas. Clerical burden, prior authorizations, paperwork, approvals.
A generalist could easily spend her whole day charting, filling out endless nonsensical forms, and using fax machines. It's an inefficient use of a doctor, and it takes away from face time with patients.
You're processing 30 patients a day and trying to get through without hurting anybody or committing malpractice, and then do all your documentation in this electronic health record that's literally a series of click boxes designed by a bean counter who's never touched a patient.
And if all that wasn't enough?
Primary care disciplines tend to be at the low end of the compensation scale for physicians.
In 2015, the average primary doctor made $195,000, which from my perspective is a lot. But the average orthopedic surgeon made $421,000. Now, if you think about going through 4 years of college, then 4 grueling years of medical school, then 3 to 6 years of soul-crushing residency, and coming out well into adulthood with a mountain of stress and debt while all your other friends have retirement accounts.
And go through all of that and be looking at a salary that's potentially only a third of what someone who goes into a subspecialty discipline can expect to earn.
That would make anyone think twice. And the reason for that pay gap is not market demand, by the way. The reimbursement rates are largely determined by a government committee. Across the board, payments are lower for the things primary care doctors do compared to the things specialists do. Other countries do things differently.
You know, if you look at Great Britain and some other countries, you know, primary care is the apex. They're the top of the food chain. So I could see, you know, we're one of the few countries, if maybe not the only one, that has more specialists than primary care doctors. That's crazy.
And the result is that we spend more than any country on healthcare, but
we're dead last among industrialized countries in every measurable health outcome.
That's Dr. Olds.
And it is in part because we don't do a good job of keeping people well, keeping them out of the hospitals, and managing their diseases in outpatient settings, all of which are tasks of primary care doctors.
Okay, so this situation sucks for primary care doctors, but even more so for us as patients. But I don't want to end the story here because each of our guests today are, in their own way, pushing for change. Dr. Olds, in his role as former dean and current medical school president, has some ideas.
I think that we are taking the wrong people into med school if what we want to accomplish is more people to go into primary care.
According to Dr. Olds, the overemphasis on GPAs and test scores selects for students who are more focused on individual achievement than community service.
The other somewhat undiscussed but I think very concerning trend is today, 80% of the medical students in medical schools in the United States today come from the top two-fifths of economic stature, meaning we're largely training the sons and daughters of wealthy Americans today, and then we're somehow surprised that they don't go into underserved areas and they don't go for positions that are more closely linked to service to communities.
In fact, at his prior position at Case Western University, Dr. Olds found that the strongest predictor of going into primary care wasn't GPA or research, it was having worked in the Peace Corps. Now, in his current role, he gets to decide who becomes a doctor, and he's made it his job to stack the deck in favor of primary care. At the University of California, Riverside, he used GPAs and test scores as a threshold.
Meaning after you get a certain grade point and a certain standardized test score, you should know there's no statistical difference between your ability to graduate from med school once you're into that group.
Moving away from a numbers game allows admissions committees to look at softer attributes, such as, say, involvement in community service or, you know, making public radio stories. In addition to looking at applicants differently, he's creating different incentives.
So one of the things I'm doing currently here at St. George's University is I offer mission-based scholarships.
If you agree to practice in one of the fields in shortage in an area of need for 5 years, your medical school is free. Public medical schools leave students in the hole for $200,000 on average, which is a steal compared to the $280,000 at private schools. So, yeah.
That eliminates the indebtedness, if you will, as a coercive factor in choosing what specialty you'll go into.
Olds isn't alone. This is becoming more and more common across the country. There's also data to suggest that the pay gap between generalists and specialists is decreasing thanks to the Affordable Care Act. But it seems like we still need to make primary care cool again in the eyes of our future doctors. Dr. West.
It's very difficult for currently practicing primary care physicians to role model what's wonderful about general medicine because they're living day to day with these issues that are driving them toward burnout.
Zubin Damania knows all about that burnout.
Yeah, so what happened was after about 10 years as a hospitalist at Stanford, I realized how broken our system was. And so it became very dispiriting. And when my daughter asked me, hey, I want to go into medicine so I can help people too, I looked at her like she was crazy. I was like, who's helping people? I'm just bandaging people up and sending them back out to be sick again.
But then...
Now, usually I don't do this, but now I'm not trying to be rude, but hey, CHF is killing you. Lungs congested up with fluid, well, my census is 32.
That's when I started making these videos as sort of a cry for help and putting them on YouTube as this alter ego Z-Dog MD with two G's because one is insufficiently gangsta. And basically, you know, parodying the system, satirizing the system, and also just kind of... trying to educate patients so that they wouldn't end up in the hospital.
These were music videos, and they got millions of views, which led to TED Talks, which led to speaking engagements.
Imagine a career where every day you get to
and
intimately
so that gave gave me an opportunity to work with Tony Hsieh, who was the CEO of Zappos, and he said, look, I see your videos. I see you're frustrated. Quit your job. Move to downtown Las Vegas. I'll give you some startup money. Try to make healthcare better in a way you think makes sense." And I was like, "What?"
So Dr. Damania started Turntable Health and teamed up with another group called Iora Health in Boston. Groups like these practice under a value-based model, meaning they get a chunk of money from insurance groups or employers to keep people healthy. Anything the patient doesn't need to spend, the practice keeps as profit. So their incentive, unlike the fee-for-service model we're used to, is to prevent disease and keep patients out of hospitals. That gives them the time
to do motivational interviewing, to look at shopping lists, to text and email patients to keep them motivated. That is how our group works, and it's very different. It's extremely rewarding.
Turntable Health is still in its infancy, and time will tell if their business model will survive. But at least they're trying. They're trying to create an environment that rewards quality over quantity. And that attempt just might inspire the medical students and residents who rotate with them. The doctors I spoke to aren't the only ones looking for solutions. If you look around, you'll see many primary care providers innovating and challenging the status quo.
There is going to come a day when it is going to be sexy and cool and awesome to be a primary care doc, where you're not going to worry about crushing debt and getting out of it because your salary is so small and your debt is so high. That's all going to change. So absolutely, I think we're at a sea change in medicine. We're at a tipping point. It has to be, or else we're just not going to have the healthcare system we need.
For The Pulse, I'm Avir Mitra.